You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight, we turn our gaze to another side of the world, to Africa. Our featured writers tonight are Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, an elder statesman from Kenya. I don't know if he'd like that description, a statesman from Kenya. And Richard Ali-Almutu, a young novelist from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And together with David Shook, poet, translator, publisher, literary whirlwind, he has hippos in Africa. David goes everywhere in the world. What can I say? They'll discuss the politics of writing in African languages, the vibrancy of the continent's cultural output, and the exciting new trends in East, West, and Central African writing. However, here is a note. We really were planning on having Richard Ali-Almutu here tonight in person. However, due to the new reality that we are all living under, he was denied a visa despite his invitation from the Library Foundation and from his publisher. Which is really astonishing. We were pretty shocked. So we are going to do our very best. His presence has been here tonight virtually. He is awake in Kinshasa, and which has, as you will read his novel, you will know that there are many power outages in Kinshasa. So we'll see if the magic works tonight, but we will try and have his presence here virtually. And we adore Richard, and we hope that we can share his presence with you. So... Richard Mutu's debut novel, Mr. Fix-It, is the first novel written in Lingala to be translated into English, and it's a super cool novel. It's a fantastic read. You can imagine yourself with the rain pouring through the cracks in the roof, dancing at a bar with a party in full swing in Kinshasa, the land of music. Richard was born in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in 1988. He won the Mark Twain Award in 2009 and published his first novel, Taboo's Nightmares, written in French, in 2011. He was the only writer working in indigenous languages for the Africa 39 anthology, which showcased the continent's most talented writers under 40. His new novel, Mr. Fix-It, is just out from Phoneme Media, as I said, translated from the Lingala. And Ngugi Wa Thiong'o is a world-renowned Kenyan author, scholar, writer, social activist. His diverse body of work includes novels, short stories, plays, articles, essays, and poems, which have been translated into over 60 languages. He's a distinguished professor of comparative literature at UC Irvine. We're so thrilled to welcome him back tonight. He's received numerous awards and 11 honorary doctorates. And after his imprisonment at Mighty Maximum Prison in Kenya in 1977, he was made an Amnesty International prisoner of conscience, and an international campaign secured his release a year later. He refers to himself as a language warrior because of his fight for the recognition of his native Gikuyu and other marginalized languages. And as I said, we're so honored. It's been several years to welcome him back to Aloud. And David Shook, our interlocutor tonight, is a poet, translator, and founder of the Los Angeles-based nonprofit publishing house Phoneme Media. He's a graduate of the University of Oklahoma and the University of Oxford in England. He's performed his poetry all over the world, from Dhaka, Bangladesh, to London, to Penn, Haiti, and his writing has been in numerous publications. David has been our literary consultant on our Oaxaca Visualizing Language Project, and he's a fantastic travel companion, another true warrior for literature, and his Phoneme Media is really making waves in the worlds of publishing and translation. So please join me in welcoming David Shook and Ngugi Wa Thiong'o to the stage. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We were planning to begin tonight's event at these lovely chairs where we'll move shortly, but we just got word by text message that the electricity has come back in Kinshasa, and we may, fingers crossed, be graced with a few moments of Richard's 3 a.m. visage. Yeah, he's in Kinshasa.
Okay.
It's 3:15 a.m., I believe. Okay. He's going to be very happy. Very happy to hear from us.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Hey, hi. Hi, good to see you.
Hello, hello.
So, Richard, I wondered if we could kick off this evening, this celebration of African languages and literatures, with your reading a brief passage from your new novel, Mr. Fix-It, in Lingala, so that we can hear it here in Los Angeles.
Okay, thank you. I do it. Mopepe kitoko. Likolo ibandi koinda. Moye zali kokende kolala pene pene ya ibale monene ya Congo. Pembeni ya ibale, moye bimi monene pe ezali kopela lokola makila. Mai efandi kimia. Mopepe ya pio ezali kokotela bato. Butu ekomi kokota malembe malembe, moye ezali kokende kolala. Na likolo, bandeke kilikili bazali kuwelela kozongela bazala na bango. Makasa ya banzete ezali kopepa se kopepa. Mopepe ezali kotinda mwa miziki lokola te mvula ezali koya. Tozali mokolo ya poso. Wana nde mokolo ki sasa eninganaka penza. Kini bisengo. Kini makambo. Kini mboka ya nkoi. Ya moprima. Ya turbo ya skol. Kini nde kiese na kiese. Ya solo. Soki ozali na bomoi tipe liwa ye kokamata yo. Otikali komona Kinshasa ata mokolo moko te. Na boye. Tika baloba. Yo penza obika kite. Mona kini ata mbala moko. Mona ebali ya Congo ya mbo kufa. Tozali kopusa na ngonga ya 18h12. Bato batoni na bikala na ndenge ya kosakana te. Na nyangwe, na kimbondo, na chibango, na super, na mugila gila. Pe suka na bango, nyon sonde matonge. Oshwe. Kuna bisengo na bisengo. Ntaba mpe soso ezali kotumba mape kolia maloko la mikate. Komilande ya som. Mabina, kini nde mokondi ya ndule, mokondi ya ndombolo.
Thank you.
Oh, wow.
I promise you that I am going to read the excerpt Richard just read in English, but because I'm a little nervous that the power might cut out again, I'm going to go ahead and ask you a couple questions, Richard. And the first has to do with this new English language edition of Mr. Fix-It. I wondered what it feels like to you as a writer working primarily in Lingala to have been translated into a language like English.
Yeah.
How does it feel?
Yeah, it was. I think that it was so wonderful for me. You know, it's the first time for a white in an African or local language to be translated directly to English. You know, sometime here in Kinshasa, we are a Francophone country, no? We have the official language, the French. So if you are white in a local language, the next language is...
Oh. We'll give him a second, guys.
Electricity will come back, don't worry.
But we got the Lingala at least. Lingala. I feel pretty good, right?
Yeah.
It's a good start.
Yeah.
Well... Okay, guys, give it up for Richard.
Yeah, we can try him. We can try him later.
We'll call him back when it's daytime there. Let him know how it went.
Okay. Right.
Ngugi, I thought we could begin tonight's conversation with a brief reading from both your book, Dreams in a Time of War, and a brief excerpt from Mr. Fixit as well. I'll go ahead and kick off with the passage from Mr. Fixit that Richard just read to us in Lingala and continue with another short passage, and then we'll hear from you. This is chapter 4 of Mr. Fixit, available along with Ngugi's book out in the lobby for a very, very affordable price, and translated directly from the Lingala by Bienvenu and Saraceni. A cool breeze is blowing. The sky is darkening. The sun is setting near the Congo River, round like a ball of fire, red as blood. The surface of the river is untroubled. The wind is getting colder, and passers-by shiver. Night sets in. The sun vanishes from the horizon. In the sky, several types of birds are noisily rushing back to their nests, while the trees are slowly swinging their branches in the breeze. The wind is humming a song, as if to say it is going to rain soon. It's Saturday, the day when Kinshasa is at its most hectic. Kinshasa full of joy. Kinshasa home to life and its troubles. Kinshasa home to beer of all kinds. Nkoi, Moprima, Turbo, Skol. Kinshasa, the land of bursting joy in all its forms. It's true, you may live to be 100 years old, but if you have never seen Kinshasa, you cannot say that you have truly lived. You have to see Kinshasa at least once. You have to see the Congo River. Now I'm going to read a brief passage from the very beginning of the book, the opening scene. Write this down too. 3 bags of rice, 4 bags of beans, 1 restaurant-sized pot, 1 brand new long-sleeve shirt still in its packaging, 1 red tie for her father, 1 tie bar, 1 belt, a pair of sunglasses, 1 pair of shoes and a set of jewelry for her mother. Don't forget the earrings, please. But, what are you arguing for? Are we going to haggle over this? Is this the market? No, but. What do you mean, no but? You have a problem with this? We aren't even finished yet. The girl's uncles haven't spoken, or her mom. Her older brothers and sisters have yet to state their demands. Ibamba's uncle sits there, speechless. The rest of his family and Ibamba himself are gesturing to him to just stop talking. There's no point. They'll have to wait for the girl's family members to finish detailing their demands. Ibamba's uncle can't help muttering to himself, "All right, I'll stop talking. At any rate, what else could I say? I just can't stand what they're doing. Are they doing it on purpose, or what? This just isn't right. Hell no." Just after Ayanga's dad stops talking, her mom immediately adds, "Thank you, my husband. As far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to ask for much. Apart from what my husband has mentioned, I'll just add a stove and just 3 pairs of shoes. And, well, I'll stop at that." Then it's Ayenga's uncle's turn to speak. "We thank you, our brothers, for approaching us honorably through the main door of our compound instead of stealing in through the window. On behalf of all of Ayenga's uncles here, as well as those who got stuck in Kinshasa's traffic and those who've stayed behind in the village, we are content to ask you for these few items. 2 baskets of kola nuts, 1 bag of salt, 1 motorboat engine, 4 bicycles, 5 buckets of palm wine, and, finally, a small envelope for Uncle Antoine from the village, because he is very ill and we urgently have to buy some medication for him. We will just end here." The sky has clouded over, and the first raindrops are already beginning to fall, so the guests are quickly ushered into the house from the patio to continue the negotiations. The rain suddenly comes crashing down, so the guests hurry into the house. But, small as it is, there's not enough room for everyone, and Ibamba's friends have to find shelter inside the neighbor's house, while a third group rushes into the landlord's house. "Uncle, we are very sorry. Could you maybe just move over your chair a bit? You're sitting right beneath the crack in the roof, right where the rain seeps in the most."
That's great. It was very wonderful seeing Richard on Skype. But at the same time, I was really a bit disappointed because I wanted to really see him face to face. For me, the excitement of coming here tonight, apart of course I love Los Angeles, I love this library and everything, but it's really come to encounter a young writer from the continent who has opted to write in an African language. You may not quite realize the enormity of this, such a decision, because it often means that there's problems sometimes in getting a publisher, getting distribution in bookshops. It means by the time you get noticed in the press, if at all, somebody else who dashes a novel in English or French will be headlined. Okay, so I was really very disappointed, and especially when I read, I was in my house in Irvine, and I was just surfing through the internet when I saw the Los Angeles Times article saying he had been denied the visa, and when I read the reasons, I became even more suspicious, because we were suspicious that he might not want to come back to. And I was wondering, that's illogical reasoning, because if he writes in an African language, that's the very reason why he would want to go back, because African languages are not a common property here. You know? So I suspect myself, this is my speculation, that what happened, they became even more suspicious. They said, this guy cannot even lie. You know, how can somebody writing in an African language be invited to Los Angeles? Right? It's like, can't he get a better reason? Right? You know, if you write in French, you can understand being invited in Los Angeles. If you're writing in English, yes. But in Lingala, Los Angeles, Hollywood, oh no. So I'm very suspicious, and I'm very sorry that they had to do that. I hope they, anyway, through technology, we have been able to have a conversation, and although through technology, our conversation was Even technology can sometimes be against African languages. like when I write on my computer in Gikuyu, it tells me the grammar is wrong, the spelling is wrong. And it's always changing the spelling from Gikuyu into some incomprehensible English. Well, anyway, I'll read a passage from my memoir, A Dreams in a Time of War. Although I might have wanted to read from my novel that I wrote in prison on toilet paper in Gikuyu, the first novel ever in Gikuyu language. So in that sense, this is more, would have been more in solidarity with Richard's book, Mr. Fix It, and so on. The first major work in Lingala, my first major work in Gikuyu. But I'm going to read this passage because when I went to school, really, I learned Gikuyu was my language of learning, okay? So my ABCD was in Gikuyu, and it's my mother who sent me to school, okay? So when I learned the music of language, Gikuyu language sounds, okay? My mother herself could not read or write, you know, but I think she had dreams of education. So the dream of education really was hers before it became mine. But I embraced it when she said, would you like to go to school? She gave me a slate, and she would actually supervise my homework. It took me some time to realize that she could not actually read and write. But she had a way of asking questions, you know, here and there and so, until she really knew what was happening in school and so on. So I remember one day when I come and say, oh, I got 100%. And she said, is that the best you could have done? And she was always like that, the notion of the best, you know. So even when I tell her proudly that I scored 100%, she asked the question in different ways until I say yes. I had tried my best. Strange. She seems more interested in the process of getting there than the actual results. So I drift through the initial classes of, you know, initial of classes, not quite understanding why I've been moved from sub B, sub A to grade 1, all within the same quarter. A skipping of classes that continues from term to term, so that within a year, I'm in grade 2. And still my mother continues to ask, is that the best you could have done? I don't know about the best that I could have done. All I know is that one day I am able to read on my own the Gikuyu primer we used in class titled Mothomere wa Gikuyu. Some sentences are simple, like one captioning a drawing of a man and an axe on the ground, his face grimacing with pain as he holds his left knee in both hands, drops of blood trickling down. The picture is more interesting than the words, which are, Kamau etemete kuguru, etemete naidanoa. Kamau has cut himself. He has cut his leg. He has cut himself their necks. So later I tackle long passages that do not have illustrations. It's a passage that I read over and over again. And suddenly, one day, I start hearing music in the words, which are, God has given the Agikoyo a beautiful country, abundant in water, food, and luscious bush. The Agikoyo people should praise the Lord all the time, for he has ever been generous to them. Even when not reading it, I can hear the music, the chosen arrangements of the words, the crescendo, the cadence. I can't pick any one thing that makes it so beautiful and long-lived in my memory. I realize that even written words can carry the music I loved in stories, particularly the choric melody. And yet, this is not a story. It is a descriptive statement. And it does not carry any illustration. But wait, it is a picture in itself. And yet, more than a picture and a description, it is music. Written words can also sing. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ngugi.
Yeah.
I heard Richard complain once that everyone, interviewers, always asked him, why do you write in Lingala? Which is a question I'm sure you must get asked too. And he asked in response, why does no one ever ask a writer, and especially an African writer, why they write in English, why they write in French? And so I wanted to pose you that second question, actually, Ngugi, because I know you began writing in English back in the 60s and early 70s, right, before you made a conscious decision to write exclusively in Kikuyu. And I wondered if you could speak about why you initially chose to write in English and why you changed your mind.
Yeah, let me first say that I began writing, I think, before most of you were born, I think. That was 1961. Right. And in those days, it was assumed for some reason that to write meant writing in English. So when I began my first two novels, The River Between and Weep Not Child, they were all in English. And so also my third novel, A Grain of Wheat. And by the way, for those who are students here, just to remind you that I wrote all those novels when I was a student. My first three novels, I was a student of English, studying and writing my essays. But there was also time for a couple of novels along the way, right?
So don't be lazy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, but I want to tell you one story which really made me think about African languages in a more, in some ways changed my mind. So I'll be very quick about this. I was at the University of Leeds doing a postgraduate program and having published two novels, The River Between and Weep Not Child, I was invited to New York for the International Pen Conference, or an International Pen, P-E-N. And then, if I remember right, Arthur Miller was the president. It's a special conference because that's when the height of the Cold War, Vietnam War protests were just about beginning. And for the first time, you know, writers from the Soviet bloc or from the Eastern bloc were allowed into the country, including Pablo Neruda from Chile, who, because he was a member of the Chile Communist Party, had been barred from this country for 30 years. He was also there. And I, as I said, have just published two novels. I'm still a student, and I'm among this sort of, it's my first time in New York, by the way, and I'm in this, and I'm a regional guest from Africa. So I'm feeling rather, trying to be, to look as writerly as anybody else, okay? So I'm sitting, but I want to soak in everything. So I'm sitting there in the audience, and I remember Arthur Miller was the chair when Ignatius Sloane, the Italian writer of Bread and Wine, was speaking. And Sloane was complaining about the not so many Italian writers were being translated at the time. And I'm listening, so I'm enjoying it. And then he says, and you know, Italian is not like one of these Bantu languages with one or two words in their vocabulary. Now, I did not mean to speak, right? I wanted to enjoy, but it forced me to speak on behalf of African languages. And I remember Arthur Miller was very gracious because he said people can sing praises to their own languages, but they don't have to bring down other languages, you know. So I remember that as well. So I go back to Leeds, And guess what? I'm in the middle of writing A Grain of Wheat, my third novel. But guess what? In what language? English. But I have just told an international big audience that African language is as good as any other. That was a very important moment, you know. The other things which happened years later, like when I returned to Kenya and I wrote in Gikuyu, my first play in Gikuyu, Gaika Deda, and then I was imprisoned for a year at a maximum security prison and so on. But really, that moment in New York in 96 is ingrained in my mind. And I remember the exact words he used at the time. Yeah.
Tell me some about...
And what you said is very interesting. When I began writing Gikuyu language, because I had to give up English to do it in Gikuyu, the same question, even today I'm asked the same question, why do you write in Gikuyu language? And it's quite true what Richard says. If a French writer says he writes in French, it's unlikely that you would ask him why you are a Frenchman, you are writing in French, all right? Or why you an English person. Why? You are English, yes. So why are you writing in English, right? Right. I mean, or Chinese. Says, I'm Chinese, I write in Chinese. You know, what? writing in Chinese? Why? Yeah, right? But I'm telling you that question is asked of every African writer who says that they write in an African language. Yeah.
I was a little nervous to publish Mr. Fix-It after I read about what happened to your first Gikuyu language publisher who had his pinky chopped off with a machete, right?
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about some of the political and social consequences of your decision to write in the Kikuyu language?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a long story, but I have there's a book of mine, I must advertise it now. it's called I first of all released it in many years ago, under the title Detained, but the New Press in New York is bringing a smaller, a slim volume of the same prison memoir called Wrestling with the Devil. Yeah, please look out for that book, okay? You know, by that I meant Wrestling with the Devil of the Devil on the Cross, the novel that I wrote in prison. But let me just describe very, very quickly my adventures or misadventures as a result of writing in Gikuyu, the decision which I made. First was 1977 when we wrote a play called I'll Marry When I Want, Gaika Deda, in Gikuyu language, performed by villagers, you know. It was the first major play in the language, you know. They did very, very well in an open-air theater, you know. But on November 16, 1977, it was stopped by the Kenyan government at the time. And I myself was later arrested on midnight of that first December 1977. So one part of the year, I was chairperson and professor of literature at the University of Nairobi. The following morning, I was in a maximum security prison without a name, only a number, okay? I have detailed all that in that memoir, which is coming out. But the key thing is when I was in prison, as I was thinking about the language issue, why This is an African government that put him in prison for writing in an African language. Of course, there may be other reasons. They maybe didn't like the fact that ordinary people could hear issues being raised in their own language and so on, you know. But anyway, I'm there thinking about this and why. I start thinking about the whole language thing in history, you know, in a colonial situation and so on. And the result is I wrote Devil on the Cross on toilet paper. You know, this is the English translation. And again, this has been released here in New York, or rather in America, by Penguin Books. Okay? Right. Now, but when I came out with this bundle of toilet paper, and, you know, my publisher, Henry Chakava, agreed to publish the novel. That's why I came out of prison after 1 year. And 2 or 3 weeks before he published the novel, he started getting very threatening calls from, you know, anonymous calls, you know, threatening and so on. In fact, at that time, that publishing house was a branch of Heinemann in London. And the London people told him, please, it means risking your life, don't publish it, okay? But Henry Chakava, sort of, he's not very political, but he's believing in the integrity of publishing. He decided to go ahead and publish it in Gikuyu. And by the way, he himself is not a Gikuyu speaker. He just believed in the idea that a publisher should be able to publish what they want to publish. So, a week before publication, people were waiting, armed people were waiting in a car, were waiting for him outside his house. And as he got out of his car, they grabbed him and tried to put him in the boot of their own car. But fortunately, at that moment, another car, unconnected, came passing by, and the thugs, you know, sort of, you know, or whoever was, the political thugs or whoever I sent, instead got a machete and cut him. He was going to cut him, but he did like his hand like that. So his finger was cut off, could be reattached. Even today, he goes like this with his finger like that. But still, he went ahead and published the novel, Devil, you know, on the cross. That element, I'm in 1982. I go into exile. I'm forced into exile. You know, many things happen. I won't go into all the details anyway. But eventually, my wife and I returned to Kenya in 2003, and I had a very important something in my luggage. My novel, Wizard of the Crow, was going to be released in Kenya in Gikuyu language. It's a voluminous novel which I wrote, by the way, here in Los Angeles, no, in California. I had not been home for 23 years. My wife, second wife, my first wife died. Second wife, whom I met here, I was going to take her home, right? 10 days before the release of Wizard of the Crow, my wife and I were attacked by armed people in our hotel who did not steal any of the things we had except my computer. 10 days before. Again, the same publisher, by the way, went ahead and published the novel anyway. So that's some of my adventures in trying to write in Gikuyu. Not always very pleasant, but they have been there. However, I must say, in that period in Kenya, we are going through a dictatorship called Moi dictatorship. And I want to just tell you, just be frank, it's not, the situation has changed. In other words, now I'm able to go to Kenya. In fact, the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, received me and my family some years ago. Yeah, so I just want to make that clear. You know, there are some changes, and that's important, you know, to us. So those are my brief adventures.
Yeah. What you mentioned this a little bit in talking about about why the government had objected to your staging the first play you wrote, but what is it about writing in your language that you think the Moi government found so threatening and so dangerous?
First of all, just again to be very clear, the first imprisonment, actually the president who was there was an Agikoyo-speaking president. The second time, it was more not Agikoyo-speaking. You know, in other words, I want to say it's maybe not quite, there may be more to it than, you know, I can really, you know, explain. But you have to understand the whole, how English language and French and other languages came to be the language of power in all colonized communities. It's a case of normalizing abnormalities. And in all cases, now we can go into this actually. I'm very fascinated in the whole issue because I've now been able to see. Okay, let me put it this way. When I was growing up, and we started, English language started being imposed as the language of education in schools, I remember being humiliated and being beaten for speaking Gikuyu language in school compound. Okay? Or being able to carry that thing like, you know, I'm a donkey. And this has always bothered me, this criminalization of people speaking their own languages. Because when you come to think of it, it's not necessary. There's nothing that says that you cannot, that you must abandon your own language in order to acquire another language. And we know this because we all go to universities, we study new languages, we add to what we have. So why is it so common that in Africa, whether it's French or Portuguese colonies, people were beaten, punished, humiliated in the school compound, associating their languages with that negativity and so on, as a condition of their mastery of French, English, and Portuguese? But wait. Is a specially African problem? Except some years ago, I went to Wales. Right? And I had Welsh children were made to carry Welsh knot when they were caught speaking Welsh in their in the school compound. Then we thought, is this an English problem? This I learned the other day at Irvine about Native American children. The first Native American school was in Carlisle, boarding school, Carlisle in Pennsylvania. And students from West were taken there from their parents. Carlisle boarding school was founded by a military guy called Pratt. And the same thing happened. You know, beatings, you know, violence, you know, humiliation when they were caught speaking Native American languages, you know. And Pratt later was actually, in his philosophy, he said it. He said, the phrase which is very well known, is to kill the Indian to save the man, right? You know, and the same sentiment all over in Japan. Japan colonized Korea, occupied Korea, 1910 to 1945, when they were defeated. During that period, Japan was Korean banned, Japanese imposed on the Korean people, and Japanese names as well. So there's all that is a common thread, is what I'm trying to say. And at the same time, people who are subjected to that can normalize the absurd, and it is normal that English and French and Portuguese or any other language of power is really the language of intelligence, of normality. And some of them may not even understand why they are revolt. They are instinctively avoiding their own language, right? Yeah. Because it's associated deep inside their psyche with humiliation, with negativity, you know, and so on. And so even parents might think that they are doing their children a favor by slapping them for speaking their own language, right? Don't speak, no, right? They may not understand. Sometimes it's psychic and been collectively and been passed on as normality, right? These are the kind of issues, by the way, I'm dealing with in most of my books, including Decolonizing the Mind. Yeah,
it's a great book. Yeah. Had a big influence on me as an even younger man, as I told you earlier today. I wondered, I think that's a very interesting point of departure in thinking about language as really an instrument of power. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a bit about translation. And I'm thinking specifically of literary translation in this instance. And to me, what seems to be a very magical ability to be able to read your work, written in Kikuyu or Richard's, written in Lingala, for example. You've talked about translation before as a language of languages.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about translation broadly, but also what it means to you to be able to share your writing, which you do in Kikuyu, with English language readers, for example.
Yeah, before I come to that, I just remembered just one more example of this, because I'm really fascinated by this language and equal power relationship. And I just remembered, actually, wait a minute, it's not even African Wales, Ireland, right, actually. You know, Ireland, interestingly, of course, their language was more advanced in the 15th, 10th centuries, more than, say, the French and so on. But there came a time when the English settlers began settling in Ireland, particularly in a place called Munster in Ireland, okay? And London began becoming anxious because the English settlers who went to Ireland, instead of making the Irish speak English, they were actually drawn to Irish. And this is speaking Irish, which is probably the normal way you speak the language, which is dominant around you. Mm-hmm. So as early as 1306, London was passing laws against people speaking English within English settlements, including English people themselves. And they passed a series of laws, like 1306, where somebody could lose their land if they were caught speaking Irish in the area. But that was not enough. By 1598, excuse me about dates, I'm not, you know, but roughly, there's this guy called Spencer. Edmund Spencer was an English poet, you know, the same time as Shakespeare. And he writes this book called A View of Ireland at the Present Time. It's a very interesting conversation between a visiting lord from London and an English settler in Munster. And they're saying, why is it you've not been able to tame the Irish? What's this? And because it's always, the logic is always, the conqueror always imposes their language on the conquered. But why have we not been able to tame the Irish? So the whole book is really is how to erase the memory of the Irish, who they are, in order to conquer them. And guess what? Naming and language were the instruments for that. So there are many examples. I don't want to go into that because I can spend the whole day talking about that, you know. But translation, I call it the language of languages. Because in reality, the problem with languages is not languages per se. All languages, big or small, you know, they are really treasuries of beauty and possibilities. English language, French, Spanish, you know, Nahuatl, you know, Swahili, Lingala, you could hear the sound of Lingala, very, very beautiful, and so on. So all languages have their own possibilities, their beauty, and so on. So the problem with languages is only when they are put in hierarchical relationship to each other, hierarchies of power, right? My language is more of a language than your language. You must learn my language, and in order to learn my language, you must stop using your own language. This is what changes. But if languages are actually connected in terms of network, like in me holding hands, and somebody else, you know, right? That's a relation of give and take, right? And that's actually, I think that's what translation can be. Like somebody, a novel written in Lingala, now we have it in English as Mr. Fix-It. A novel that I wrote in prison, Devil on the Cross, Shaitan Madara Faine, is available in English. It does not negate the one originally written in Koyo, right? You know, Russian literature, some of us don't know Russian at all, but we enjoy reading Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and so on, right? So translation is an enabling enterprise. That's why I call it the language of languages.
And it can serve as a sort of equalizer in it's, those hierarchies.
Of course, in a situation where it's one-way traffic, it can also be not so. But when in a space of equality, languages and cultures, not just languages and cultures can give to each other and enrich each other. You know, there's no culture that cannot learn something from another culture and another language. But when they are put in a hierarchical relationship, this is where the problem begins. And you see some languages where they fight, they say, me, our language is being suppressed, and so on. But they're quite happy to suppress another language, right? Say Spanish. In Spain, it marginalized Catalan and Basque and another one, Galician, for instance. In Latin America, Spanish is marginalized Native American languages. Here in America, States is marginalized. Okay? And people say, or French in Quebec, marginalized, but marginalized in another area. You know, what I was saying is that if languages and cultures relate, networkingly, they have a lot to give to each other. Mutual enrichment, really. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, we've come to the portion of our evening where we'd like to invite all of you, our audience, to ask questions. We have a microphone floating out here, so I ask that you wait for it to reach you, please.
Number one. Yeah. So my name is Brandon Sankara. I deal a lot with trying to kind of figure out identity as far as being a descendant of people who were brought here, and then, you know, people from the Gold Coast mixed with people from Angola, mixed with people from Congo, mixed with all these different cultures, languages, histories. And so being now someone who can't necessarily pinpoint my ancestry to a particular place and say, you know what, this is the language I'm going to go back to because now I've learned who I am and I want to get away from using English to evoke my revolutionary spirit. But whereas you had Gikuyu to fall back on, what do you say to a group of people like us who are trying to reason our present situation in the history of colonialism, try and develop languages, and, you know, move away from English ourselves? What's your take on that, given our history here?
Let me try this one. It's a very, very difficult one. But let me try. Give a crack now. First of all, in terms of America and African-American, again, I want to tell the same story. I want to go back to Ireland. I find Ireland to be very endlessly fascinating for me, okay? You know, Spencer, who wrote A View of Ireland at the present time, was actually a settler neighbor of another English person called Walter Raleigh. And Walter Raleigh would later become a founder of the first English colony in the Americas, Virginia, correct? I think it's called a fair, I mean, you know, not, my history is not all that good, but, you know, we remember running Virginia, okay? Now, you remember as at some time, I'm not saying it was through Raleigh, but I'm talking about what happened then to the plantation on which the enslaved worked, enslaved Africans, okay? African languages were banned, you know. It's not that people lost their languages. They were actually banned here in the Caribbean. And not even that, even a talking drum was banned, you know, to the extent some people were actually hanged when they were caught speaking their languages, okay? It was as brutal as all that, right? Now, let's see how resistance can work. First of all, English settlers here, Spanish, Dutch, and others, English and so on, their linguistic connection to Europe was not disconnected, okay? African is connected. What do they do? Something happens. Great. Actually, something which I think I would be proud of anyway. Out of being denied their language, brutally, and not always getting, they take the language of imposition and impose on it the patterns of memory of their own language and rhythms and so on, you know. And what do we get? Initially, we get what have been called ebonics, but let's go back to the roots in this. The spiritual. Let's see the culture produced by that language, whatever. Take the spiritual. Even today, people know that the melodic power of the spirituals all over the world, even commercials, right? Very, very powerful. So what do you say about a language that produces that kind of power? And it is in the spiritual that ideals of freedom and liberation began to be articulated, although articulated in religious terms. Okay? So by the time people come to talk about American independence and we are born free and all that, this has already been the ideals already embodied in the spiritual, right? Take something else. Take jazz, again. Jazz is a rescue of the discarded, if you like. Yeah? So people don't have the instruments. The master throws one, you know, get one, and one is thrown away probably, and the orchestra, you get another instrument, you add pieces, you create a new sound, jazz. And we can go on to hip-hop and so on all over the world, you know. We can talk about the influence of that language on, say, literally, literature, American literature as a whole. Faulkner, Mark Twain. So, for me, I would say, wait a minute. That language has been able to do all those things. What other language can really claim as much impact on the rest? So, in that case, what I'm trying to say initially is that, no, you start with whatever language you have. It's not a matter of negativity. Just what you have, you start with that. Then add other languages, okay? So if I were here, I would say, if I'm African-American, for instance, I would say Ebonics, then master the language of power, which is the standard English. The language of power is very, very important. If I were to learn another language, then it would be, in that case, I would choose between African on the continent and elsewhere. So it's not a matter of saying, I don't have a language. Use whatever you have or whatever we have as our starting point is what you do with the choices you make about additional languages. One of the African intellectuals I like very much, and he's not talked about as much these days, and I'm sorry, Paul Robeson. It makes me sad that somebody whose voice literally used to embody the vision of millions, not only here but in Africa and other places, you know, he seems to have been, he's forgotten as if he didn't exist. Paul Robeson. But you know, Paul Robeson, he knew 7 African languages, including Yoruba, right? Of course, in addition to his English and other things, yeah.
I think we have time for one more question. Two more? Okay.
You began writing in English, and then you wrote in your natural language. Then there was a time that had to be translated into English. So I'm wondering, because you could write in English yourself, did you choose to translate that in your subsequent books into English yourself? Did you have someone else to do it? Were you responsible for choosing? And then how hard is it to see a book that you wrote and then it's translated? Are you always happy with the translation? And how important is that to you going forward?
In my own case, practice is quite. I've done some like this. I did my own translation of this one, Devil on the Cross, and Wizard of the Crow. But I have some others, Matigari, and a few stories for children translated by somebody else. You know, but a writer cannot always check all the translations. For instance, my books have been translated into more than 50 languages in the world. And I have no idea. I can't even check that, you know. The key thing is that they are translated. And talking of translation, I just want to mention one thing in connection with Richard. I would like to ask you, when you leave here, when you're next to your computer, please go and check the story called The Upright Revolution. Upright. It will tell you how humans came to walk upright, actually. Yeah? You know, and all to do with the, I don't tell you the secret, but really the problem was the both hands and legs. Human beings used to walk on all fours, but you know, but you look at the hands and legs, they're almost like each other. They're like cousins. And so they are sibling rivalry. Anyway, so look up The Upright Revolution, please, and the journal called Jalanda, J A LADA. This is a story which I wrote in Gikuyu, actually here in Irvine, for my children, called The Upright Revolution. Itwikare amarugaro kana kire gitumara madimarugi, The Upright Revolution of Why Humans Walk Upright. It was in my drawer until some young people in Kenya, they are part of a Pan-African collective, and they asked me for a story because they wanted to see how African language can talk to each other. So they wanted to start their journal with a story written in an African language. And that's why I remember that story, which I had written for my daughters here in Irvine. Okay? I gave them that story. And the story now is in over 65 languages in the world. I think 50% of them are African. And Richard Mutu is one of the translators into Lingala, right? Right? That's the connection, right? Right. So please check the story. And they are encouraging people. They are now trying to get translated into Native American languages. Just go to their website, tell them you want to translate, and they work with you. Right.
That's great. I think we have time for one last question, and then very briefly, I have heard that the power has come back on in Kinshasa.
Oh.
And Richard would like to wish us good night.
Oh, okay. That's very nice. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Brother Ngugi. When I was at Cal State LA 2001, and I was working on a master's in post-colonial literature, my teacher, Himachari, turned me on to Decolonizing Your Mind and your work. And then I also studied about negritude with the Francophone African writers. And I was wondering, is there some type of negritude that happened also in East Africa? And the next thing I wanted to ask is, when the children in South Africa rebelled, I think in 1976, I know Mary McKeever sings about it, the children wanted to speak their native language in South Africa, and they were told in school that they can't speak their mother tongue at school because, South Africa, they couldn't. So the children marched out of school, and they were shot down. So those are two totally different things. The negritude, is there some kind of negritude from East Africa? And also, how did people respond from the African continent when this terrible thing happened in 76 in South Africa? Thank you.
Yeah, I'll be very, very quick about this because it's a long history. The negritude, of course, is a movement which was largely rooted among African intellectuals of the French. But it was influenced also by Harlem Renaissance, of Langston Hughes and others, Claude McKay and others, and so on. And that had also some connection with Afro-Cubanism and Afro-Brazilianism, and it's a whole movement. And it's also influenced some writers of English expression. So that whole idea of the sense of Africanness, all the time there. But the question of South Africa, just to correct a little bit, the South African situation is a bit complicated because I think you are thinking of the Soweto uprising of 1976. 60, because ANC was banned in 1960. So the Soweto uprising was much later when the Afrikaner, in South Africa there was English, Afrikaner, and so there came a period when Afrikaner, part of the white establishment, want to impose Afrikaner as the language of education in South Africa. And children revolted, and actually they didn't demand African languages, then they demanded English, by the way. Just to correct that one a little bit, but still they were killed and nothing happened. This is through the politics of language between Africana and English as to which would be the language of power among in South Africa, both were committed to marginalizing African languages, actually, you know. But within that, and there was a reason why the children revolted, because although African languages in South Africa were being used, African, but the government restricted the content, what available in African languages. So they realized if they were given Afrikaner only, then the government would be able to restrict their access to knowledge altogether. That's why, among many other reasons, that's what's also behind that. Yeah. But nevertheless, it is true, language was an issue. But in South Africa today, I was in South Africa in May, in Cape Town, you know, Johannesburg, on Decolonizing the Mind. 2,500 people turned up. You know, faculty, students, members of parliament, lawyers turned up, you know. In Cape Town, 1,500. In Eastern Cape, 1,500. Right? Because the issue of decolonizing the mind is now being discussed all over the continent, you know, particularly in South Africa. It's such a force that I keep on getting invited, but I feel like I don't really want to go there too many of because I would like them to debate it among themselves in their own terms. But not only South Africa. Decolonizing the mind is now becoming an issue over the whole world in so many ways, because even a colonized nation need to be decolonized. You know, decolonized, not just decolonized of those who were colonized. Decolonizing mind is really a global need or phenomenon. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, guys, cross your fingers.
Okay. Can you cross your fingers, please?
Ron.
Oh. 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 Yeah?
Hey!
Oh.
We're just finishing up our program here, but we wanted to wish you a good morning in Kinshasa.
Yeah.
And everyone here has promised me that they're going to buy your book and read it. So have a great day.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, you can't see me. Just say, oh, okay, let me just say hi.
Ngugi's coming to say hi to you.
Okay.
Hi, and I forgot to tell you, to thank you very much because you are part of the translation of the Uprising Revolution into Lingala.
Okay.
Yeah. I mentioned that here as well, okay? Yeah.
Yeah, and I make also the song.
Huh?
And I make also the song of the translation.
Oh, the sound, Lingala. Yeah. It's because in the
on the website, there are audio recordings.
Audio recordings are the same in the different languages in which they are done, you know.
Yeah.
So thank you very much. And we continue collaborating, okay?
Okay.
We continue our connection, okay?
Great. Give it up for continue
the good work, guys.
Okay.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boyapongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.